Welcome to the Jeff Knows Inc. Show with your host, Jeff Lopes, where we bring you the world's top athletes, celebrities, entrepreneurs, influencers, and their journeys to success.
Welcome to episode 224 of the Jeff Knows Inc. podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Lopes. Super excited for this week's guest. He's a MMA combat sports commentator and martial arts historian, a good old Canadian boy, Robin Black. You guys are truly going to enjoy this conversation. Like all weeks, we truly, truly appreciate everyone's feedback, comments, reviews. This is what keeps the engine running. I always pick one listener that spent the time to do a review, and this week I'm picking a Spotify listener. Jess123 wrote, "Growing up in Seattle, I was always a Mariners fan. And when I saw your episode with Brett Boom, I was super excited. Great episode. Thank you, Jess, for taking the time out of your busy schedule to write a review. This is, like I said, what keeps the engine running. Please leave your reviews, leave your feedback. This is what helps us as a podcast grow. Appreciate everyone out there. Sit back, enjoy this episode. Thanks."
This podcast is proudly sponsored by Nutritology. Nutritology is a company that I actually was personally using for quite a while before they came on board sponsoring us. So completely committed to this brand. What makes it so awesome is they are a Canadian brand, and you guys are more than aware that I stand behind my Canadian brands. Majority of Nutritology's products are made in Canada, so you know they're committed to their quality. And all their products are registered with Health Canada, and they all own their own NPN, natural product number, ensuring the highest safety and quality. Another amazing feature is they have tailored solutions. Whether you're an athlete striving for peak performance or professional just looking for mental clarity, or individuals just dedicated to a healthier lifestyle, I've personally worked with my nutritionist to help tailor my supplements to live a cancer-free life. And Nutritology supplements are a big part of that. What I love even more is their huge variety of organic products like turmeric, lion's mane, and moringa leaf. So if you guys are ready to take your health to the next level, make sure to check out a proudly Canadian brand, Nutritology. You can find them on Amazon or directly on their website as www.nutritology.com. That's www.nutritology.com. We are live on the Jeff Knows Inc. podcast. I'm super excited to have on Robin Black. I've known Robin. Our journey actually connected probably about, I would say probably about 14, 15 years ago.
Yeah.
I was at MMA Expo when I first met you. For my brand Kimura, we had a booth. You came by the booth, we talked, and I just been watching your journey ever since, where you kind of got into MMA, you became an athlete in it from the music world, and now, God, you're traveling the world as a comic. There's just so much layers to this. I love the whole Canadian content of it, and I love it. Let's get back to Robin. Growing up, music, the love for music, where did that all start?
Yeah, I mean, my big passion was always martial arts. I was a weird kid.
It was, like, huh?
It really was. Yeah, yeah. I did martial arts as a little child. And so I was one of these. I had two brothers, and my parents, we lived in a small town in Manitoba called Pinawa, which has a nuclear research plant there. So it's a very strange place, like a science town. Yeah, so everybody's parents are like, you know, masters and PhDs in physics and all these kinds of things. It's a very smart place. My dad was the school superintendent. So he was in charge of education. And I did well in school, but I just didn't have interest in those things. I liked gymnastics, diving, platform, 1 meter and 3 meter diving I did, and martial arts. I did taekwondo as a little kid. And my parents tell the story now, like fairly truthfully as you can tell stories that are 40 plus years old, that they were just like, I kept saying I wanted to take karate. That was what I was, you know. It ended up being taekwondo, but you know, that they met together and they were like, look, you know, he's a weird kid. Like, he doesn't seem interested in anything and nothing keeps his attention. And he's asked about this now 20, 30 times. Let's figure out how to do it. So they would, both of my parents were professionals. They would drive me almost 2 hours each way and then sit there in the car for 2 hours while I trained three times a week from the time I was barely 10, not even 10. And I have two other brothers and they both work, and they did that for me because they were like, our kid could end up in jail or who knows what's going to become of him. But this he seems to really like. And then as a kind of a teenager, I grew my hair long, and, you know, it was the 80s. I wore eye makeup and stuff. And I, lots of girls liked me for the first time. So that actually was as much a driving force about music as being a teenager and suddenly being attractive to attractive girls briefly for the first time in your life. That's what kind of got me into, you know, singing in a rock band and being a performer. I love performing. Not a great musician, not a great singer, but I like performing. And, you know, I was interested in girls. So that was really, it was almost more of a sidetrack, you know, 15 or 20 years in music from my real lifelong passion of martial art.
That is crazy. So your band, I mean, you toured, like you got up there. Like considering what you said, it wasn't your passion. You really immersed yourself in that. And it was funny because one of my staff here was just, he's the one that brought up the name. Obviously, the Robin Black Intergalactic Rock Stars was the name of your band. How long were you guys together for, and when did it start? Because it led to other things, like you being on Much Music as a host of a reality show. There's those other elements that it led to, right? So where did that start? How long did it take? And when did it kind of slow itself, the progression of it? Because you did play at actually decent venues in Ontario and stuff, right?
Yeah, and you know, big festivals and stuff, and we toured England, and we went to Italy, and Ireland and Scotland, and that whole area. We were actually bigger there than we were in Canada, because they have more of an audience for that kind of music that was kind of baked in. I started in Manitoba. I went to hairdressing school, so I became a hairdresser, you know, cutting hair and coloring hair and stuff. That's what I because I figured, truthfully, in retrospect, I was like, well, I don't want to get a haircut. I had really, really long black hair. And I was like, I don't want to get a haircut. So I can't work in a bank. I want to do something in, you know, that'll allow me to express myself as a kind of odd individual. And so I went to hairdressing school. And then suddenly, that was one of the great decisions that I had made, because from 19-ish until mid to late 30s, when I became a full-time fighting, you know, like I lived and trained as a professional athlete and fought people in cages, that, you know, close to 20 years, I had a job that I could do. I could travel to tour. Later, I could travel. I could go and train and book, control my own world, control my own schedule and cut hair. And, I'm a very driven person in almost everything for whatever reason. I credit it to martial arts, but there's some, you know, my father grew up on a farm. Nobody in his family had ever had more than a grade 2 education. My father went and, you know, essentially completed his PhD just without doing the dissertation. He went right through all, and so work ethic from the farm through my dad, again, like nobody had ever finished grade 3. And he went to, you know, off on his own and did that. That kind of is taught to you, you know, and he talks even about the first, so my original last name was Ledoux. I changed it to Black. The first Ledoux, Joe Ledoux, went from France. He was 16. And all he got on a boat, and all he knew was, if you work this land, they'll give it to you. If you clean and clear this land in some place called Minnesota. And then he apparently committed some kind of crime and stole a horse and went to Manitoba, across the border. Like, there's an odd genetic component that goes all the way back on my father's side to work and drive and all these things. It's weird. It's fun talking to you about it, because you can just have this type of very disorganized thinking and very disorganized sort of putting out of thoughts that I think well in these situations. Yeah. Like, I enjoy putting weird pieces together and jumping back generations. That's how I think. Like, that's how I think.
It's funny, because that's how my mind works too. And I'm loving this conversation, because it's so many layers to you. Like, I had no clue about the hair. So you did the hairdressing for how long? So all the way through the process, where were you working in Ontario?
I was in Manitoba, and we had a band there called the Ballroom Zombies. And we did pretty well. We'd started to tour, and I'd started to learn the business. A lot of these skills make real sense to now, where I'm a freelance creator.
Yeah.
You know, people say, we'll use the word influencer, but nobody in their 50s should ever be called an influencer. That just sounds absurd to me. But creator makes sense. I make stuff.
Yeah.
And now I do it freelance, and I do my own, you know, I have my own clients and sponsors and travel. And you know, I work for 5 or 6 or 7 different MMA and martial arts shows. A lot of these skills I learned in the band, where you'd book your own venues and and book your own travel and so forth. Through that entire process, I was a hairdresser because the band made essentially $0. Yeah. So I would go to work and I would book myself a half hour appointment. I'd do 10, 12 hour days. So I'd have 20 to 25 clients and I would make maybe close to $50 each. That was $1,000 a day a human can make just being ultra driven, doing the best work you can and not giving yourself a break. If you do 4, 5, 6 days of that, you can take some of that money and invest it in touring your band. So being a hairdresser was, it was creative. It was self-expression. It was an artistic job. You're around music all day and beautiful people. And it was a fun job. I would recommend it to anybody. I'm proud of doing that job. And when I go and get my hair cut, I'm always, this is such a cool gig. But it was all of those things, but it was also financed my band for that entire time. So I worked at a place after Manitoba. I worked at a place on Queen Street West in Toronto called Coupe Bazaar. Okay. And Coupe Bazaar is kind of this, becomes known, this kind of rock star hair salon.
Yeah.
So when my band was now on Much Music, and we were, you know, touring and we were in magazines because that was the thing then. People would come in and get their hair cut by me because it was Robin Black, the guy that you saw sing in a band. No way, I could get my hair cut by him for $70. And so the whole thing kind of made sense. We rehearsed just off of Queen Street, two blocks from where I cut hair all day to make the money to finance the thing. But that never seemed weird to me. And today it still doesn't. I never in my life have ever chased money. I've always found that if you chase quality work or art or enjoyment or discovery or curiosity or learning, you'll have the better chance to likely make money anyways. And that's proven true for me always.
It's 100%. 100%.
Yeah. It's proven to be true. Yeah.
I apologize. So you continued from there. So as you're doing the band and everything progressed, when did you slowly progress away from the hairdressing?
This episode is proudly sponsored by Kimoraware. Kimoraware is a Canadian martial art and boxing equipment brand established in 2006, supplying over 1,500 gyms with premium equipment right across North America. If you're looking for boxing martial art equipment, Kimoraware's got your back. Check them out at www.kimoraware.com. That's KimuraWear.com.
So it wasn't slow, really. So by the time... So my first fight, I think, was 2008. I'm going to say 2008. I was 39 fucking years old when I took my first pro MMA fight. So around 2005 or 6, trained full time. And I mean full time with that sort of driven mind that and passion and hyper focus that I kind of always developed through being a bad singer in a successful band and all the other things that I did. It took me, 2-3 years of full-time training to get to my first fight. But just before that, in the 5, 6, 7 years before that, traveling in a rock band, and you're kind of on the treadmill of the business of it. The music was fun. The audiences were fun. But the business was very difficult. So that same mindset where I'm just like, if you just do 25 haircuts a day, you can finance the thing to do the art. That started to feel that never-ending treadmill. But we started to use a lot of drugs, cocaine and speed. Speed, especially when we were in Europe, people would just give it to us. We'd drink a lot. You know, you'd find yourself on tour for 2 months through Europe, and you would drink in the morning. Like, obviously, this is not a healthy way. So you've got sort of that drive to succeed, whatever that looks like. But then you're kind of sabotaging yourself through the nature of the day-to-day because of kind of, for whatever reasons. There's no excuse, and you can never make excuses for bad choices. But often bad choices just sort of find their way in, and you don't work hard to get them. So we're drinking. We're doing lots of drugs. We're eating terribly. You know, the only exercise we're getting from, I was still doing flying kicks and stuff in the band. I was jumping spinning kicks on stage and stuff. So, you know, in that hour and 30, 40 minutes a night, you get some exercise, but no real exercise, terrible food, bad sleep, drugs, alcohol, really bad lifestyle. So I was in England and I was sort of I don't even remember whose house I was in. But we are on day 4 of a crazy stretch, very little sleep. And I have a seizure. I had like a hypoglycemic seizure. and fully locked up my body. I felt like electricity into my arms, and I just shut down. And now in my interpretation, that experience lasted a second or two. But very similar to when somebody gets knocked out in a fight, they could be laying there for 6 minutes, but their brain will have no memory of that. So 1 minute you're fighting, the next minute a doctor has a light in your face and he goes, what day is it? You don't remember. And it was the same thing. I thought it was seconds. I found out later it was like a minute or 75 seconds of seizing. I felt terrible. My body, there was all kinds of pain in my body after. So I came back and I went to a doctor, and the doctor says, I tell him everything, you know. And I said, you know, doc, have I done any serious damage? And he pauses and he literally goes, you're a fucking idiot. That was his exact diagnosis. He explains that it was actually a hypoglycemic seizure caused by the massive quantities of Red Bull that we were taking with vodka and Red Bull, drugs to keep you awake, then more sugar, no food. That actually when after many, many hours, and I'd kind of slept a bit, 6-7 hours the night before, as the alcohol is leaving your body, it's drawing sugars out of you, yeah, and your sugar's crashing. And so it's kind of something that happens to people in non-dangerous situations and more normal situations, but it was something created through my behavior. So, and I said, I'm like permanent damage. I'm only 35 or whatever I was at the time. And he says, well, if you change your life, if you change your behavior, there's no reason this should happen again. And I think within 36 hours, I went to a jiu-jitsu gym. And I had never trained jiu-jitsu. I was black belt in taekwondo. I trained Muay Thai and karate and lots of other things, but I had never trained jiu-jitsu. I went into a jiu-jitsu gym, Toronto BJJ, and I started training. And I went back. I trained about 6 times that week. And then I started training twice a day, Tuesday, Thursday, and 3 times a day, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, walking back to do haircuts in between. And by the end of 3 weeks, I'm like, I'm going to become I'm going to have a professional mixed martial arts fight. Because all of a sudden I could punch and kick again. I was moving. My body was suddenly feeling good. And I literally, and I know that that's a punchline, like on Friends and stuff, like that a guy decides, I'm going to be a cage fighter now. But I literally, suddenly I was like, you know, the last 15 years of my life, the thing I'm most passionate about suddenly returned and everything makes sense. Suddenly my body isn't full of alcohol and drugs. I'm starting to see things. I'm eating quality food. I'm sleeping good at night. I feel stronger. It, within weeks, I got, and they gave me my blue belt, I think, honestly, maybe 9 weeks. I got a blue belt from under Wagner Fabiano's line.
George Brito?
George Brito wasn't there yet.
Okay.
It was
Wagner,
Kareem Al Said.
Yeah.
It was under Wagner, who's on black belt under Wagner. It was Nova Yanao. And then I started competing in jiu-jitsu. And then I pitched a TV show to Much Music, who I'd already been doing work through, saying, I'll still wear my eye makeup and have crazy hair and stuff, and say, this guy's going to fight a pro MMA fight in a year. And we made a pilot. And suddenly I was like, no, I know exactly where my life is now going. And I'll tell you honestly, within 6 months or a year, I understood. I thought I was going to fight once. I've had 9 pro MMA fights because I didn't understand enough after 1, 2, and then a win, and then a win with a belt, you know, in a regional show, and then a bad loss, taken out on a stretcher. I needed more experience to understand, but I understood that where my path was to commentate and analyze. I knew that in 2006. And I did a little bit and a little bit and a little more, and then realized I was not that good at it, and then not that bad at it, and then pretty good at it. And then you have to get a little worse to get better. So it's the same path. But I knew, I didn't imagine my studio. I didn't imagine Instagram and TikTok and these things. This is the point. I'll fight one time, and then I'll earn the right to be able to talk about fighting and to analyze it and to talk about it and travel and commentate it and stuff. But I didn't earn it after one. And even after nine, I'll often say, you know, people will say, well, you don't have to fight to commentate fighting. And it's like, I had 9 pro MMA fights and lived and trained as a professional athlete for 8 or 9 years. And all it's given me is the understanding about how little I know about fighting. So if that's true for me, then what could you possibly understand with only three fights or one fight or no training? Like the amount of the nonstop amount of information, the 99% of all information about martial arts beneath the surface of what's talked about on television is only accessible within the experience. And I have barely enough experience to discuss it, but I've dedicated, you know, now 20 years of my life to doing it. So I suddenly feel like, okay, I don't hate where I 2,500 pieces of content, 3,500 breakdowns, 800 shows of commentary. Now I'm like, I still don't know very much.
It's been that many.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah. The, we worked at, do you remember Fight Network? It still exists.
Of course.
Fight Network still exists. But back when I was there, it was like a big, wasn't big. It was big contextually to me at the time. It was small compared to TSN or ESPN or these things, but we were doing something special. But back then, John Ramdean and I, there were some weeks where we would do three or four full cards a week. They would go and take Old Pancrase or Deep or a Sengoku. I always get it confused with the puzzle game. And edit together like 20 fights, and it'd be like Best of Pancrase, episode one, Boss Rutan versus, and we would recall all of those. And sometimes it'd be 20 fights. Sometimes we'd do 60 fights a week commentating. Now, it wasn't live, but it was as live. It was live for us, no retakes. And we would do, so there were, by the time I left Fight Network, there was probably 500 fight cards that I'd commentated. And 300 of them were from other eras. And we would commentate them through the lens of today. So it'd be like 2015. And we're watching Pancrase from 2001. And we'd say, you notice Boss is gripping the shoulder here and using pressure. Nobody does that anymore. But what he was doing then is he believed this, and this is why. And so it forced you to not only learn, you know,
the technical side,
aspects of technical side, but history, and then the history of the technical side, and then interpret. So there was just so much learning that we got to do. And then, yeah, I think this year I probably did 30 weekends of fighting, and sometimes there'll be two shows on a weekend. So I'm sure I did 40 shows this year. A lot of that is, you know, a lot of these things are all good fortune, and then figuring out how whatever setback you have is not too big a setback. It's just different. Once I kind of freed myself of this desire to kind of work for the UFC, and then suddenly went, hey, wait a second. If my options are work for the UFC, which is hyper corporate and lots of layers of bosses telling you what not to say and what you have to say and creating this sort of narrative to sell the audience, or I could have access to literally every other show on earth. That sounds a lot more fun to me. Now there's variation. You do Game Bread Bare Knuckle for Jorge Masvidal. It's a completely different thing. They want you to swear where appropriate. They don't want you to wear a suit. Like, you know, and you do karate. Suddenly the martial artistry is different. So all of these things, or I traveled to China or Russia and did, you know, amateur and world championships in traditional martial arts. So all the learning that you do over here, since you spend a lot of time going, wait a second, the stuff that is being said on corporate television, very little of it is true. Most of it is around selling you something or telling you what to think or like getting you to buy things. And most of it is at least misleading or only partially true. And often what you see in corporate television, corporate fight television, is complete bullshit. And the commentators aren't trying to lie to you. They're just so deep in the soup that they think the soup is, you know, the soup that they're eating. And really somebody else made it, told them what to eat. It's an imperfect analogy, but yeah, corporate martial arts television programs are 99% bullshit. And you can only discover that by getting outside of that bubble and examining martial art, not through the lens of a television production and through the lens of the real martial artistry. And so that's been of dramatic importance to my entire thing that I've been, my category one weird me thing that I've developed.
Hey, quick question for you. Are you someone who wants to be fit, healthy, and happy? And what if I told you you could get your dream body by simply just listening to a podcast? I'm Josh.
And I'm KG, and we are the hosts of the Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast.
Listen, we get it. Fitness isn't easy. Carbs, no carbs.
Just stop, okay? It doesn't have to be that complicated. And that's why we made this podcast. We get straight to the facts so you can become your best you.
So the way to check us out is click the link in the show notes or search Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast on any of the major podcast platforms. We'll see you soon.
This whole process you've been going on is like, there's so many things I want to talk about. I'm going to do a shout out to the Fight Network because that came in a time when it was really taking off. The UFC had taken off. The whole fight scene has really, it started getting such a platform, and having a Canadian based TV show or TV network that was completely MMA. It was a big deal. It was like, this is the next, my mindset with the Fight Network was this was going to be the next big thing. And I remember I went twice to this, to actually, I guess you call it your corporate office or your studio, which was this cool studio setting with the wood floors.
All gone now. Awesome. I know. Yeah. It was so cool.
It was so, so awesome in there, right?
Yeah. So that was a very dramatically massive, you know, if any of us should look at wherever we are and be able to trace, you know, what happened, what we did, and how we responded. And if you are happy with where you are, some of those things were good luck. Some of those things were preparation. Yeah. Some of those things were just a random decision that worked. Fight Network was a really important part of my path. You know, I have my own business now, which I live like an artist and get paid like a neurosurgeon. And it blows my mind, right? Like I just literally do my thing the way I like it. And my audience likes it. So I'm very happy with how this has all developed, but it couldn't have developed without that stage for a lot of reasons. One, we just got to get loads of work. Like, you know, what anyone who's ever achieved any level of being good at anything did a lot of work somewhere. The Beatles, who were the greats of their era, and we shouldn't compare ourselves to the greats, but we use them as examples. You know, they were once trapped in Berlin for months doing five sets a day, just over and over, work.
Yeah.
Learn it, you know, immerse in it. You develop a type of fingertip knowledge, a different thing. You know, if when a guest fighter comes on and he's on the third commentary show he's ever done, and I'm on 800, we are not doing the same thing. And that's not a judgment. That's just you aren't doing the same thing. Yeah. So you don't connect to it the same. You don't understand it. You know, Serena Williams, when I hit a tennis ball and she does, that's not the same thing, right? We don't understand it in the same way. And so all the work gets you there. So that was important. Then there was massive freedom because nobody really knew what they were doing. And we had a couple of key producers who literally was like, well, just, you guys do the thing. We're like, okay, let's just do the thing, you know? And so they would empower you to do stuff. But then also, you know, there are often what not to do stories. And they may be actually a very successful business as they're a much smaller business now. They don't have that studio anymore. They don't have, you know, the world of content creation that we had built at the time. So they may well be successful under those circumstances. But we were in a position in about 2016, 2017 to today be one of the largest purveyors of martial arts content, and they didn't understand it. And I went in and had meetings. So Leonard Asper is the boss, and he's a very smart guy. And in between him and wherever you are, there are a couple layers of executives, which is often true. You know, if you were at Fox, it would be 8 layers. Here, there was maybe 2, right? Those layers will often spend time prepping the owner with their thinking. And their thinking was, this digital stuff is not worth anything. And that those two people, and you know, we had built hundreds of thousands of followers on YouTube. We were one of the biggest providers of YouTube martial arts content at the time, but we were a television network and our subscriptions were shrinking. So they were like, we got to do something to get our cable subscriptions up. Of course, 2023, we understand that was an error. Cutting your digital department is a dramatic, when you already have a large wedge of the thing, is a dramatic error, right? Again, how you respond to your decisions and what you do, they could well have be successful in the iteration that they are now. But nobody will look back and say, cutting a fairly inexpensive, large, successful digital department that owns a large part of the audience in 2017, nobody will look back and say, well, that was a great idea. It was a bad idea, right? I always look at when these types of failings as one of two things, incompetence or sabotage, right? Yeah. And either you don't know what you're doing or you wreck it because of something. And sabotage doesn't mean I'm trying to wreck the company. Sabotage often means through preserving my own self-interest, I am going to push us in directions of bad choices. So, but that lesson was key to me because when it happened, so they basically, I was in California visiting my wife who's in musical theater. And John Ramdean texts me and he goes, it's been great working with you. I got fired. I'm like, oh, John Ramdean got fired. What's happened? And like 4 minutes later, 10 minutes later, like our producer, Bob, who now works at DAZN, he said, it's been great working with you. I got fired. I'm like, oh my God. Oh shit. And I'm like, so I text the boss. I'm like, hey, I hear people got fired. Am I okay? And he wrote, call me. And I'm like, oh. And they cut essentially the entire department for whatever reason. There's always reasons that you are not privy to. But so I was like, okay. So I interviewed at Fox at the time and they brought me in to they were trying to figure out how I could possibly fit in there. And there was some things I was looking at. I was doing work within the UFC bubble already, although that was already revealing to me how corporate and really political and weird and kind of just, I'm a bad fit for that. And that's a bad fit for me. But at the time, but I was also looking and going, wait a second, this is not unique to, and this was 2017, I think. Yeah. This is not unique to this company. This kind of cutting is going to happen at wherever I'm going to find a job.
Oh yeah, 100%.
The only thing that is logical is to build my own business. To build my own business so that when the world changes again and again and again, it is your agility, your ability to make the right call then, instead of relying on your bosses to make it, because they'll usually make the wrong one. Because the real move in 2017 was cut executives.
Yeah.
Right? Keep creators, cut executives. What executives are going to be just going along with that idea? They're going to be putting up roadblocks towards that idea. And suddenly you realize, hey, wait a second, I have very little power. In some of these places, I have very little creative control. And you look at what makes people happy. The ability to have some autonomy over your own life is a big driver of happiness. So wait a second. From an artistic standpoint, I should figure that out on my own. From a growth standpoint as a martial artist, I should figure it out on my own. From the having a direct relationship with an audience who never gets mistreated because you care about them, I should do that on my own. From my own personal happiness and autonomy, the business, the technology, oh, I should do it on my own. Okay. And then suddenly I looked and I thought, that's terrifying. I don't know anything about social media. I don't know anything about YouTube. I don't know anything. I don't know how to work this thing. And that's how I felt in 2017. And today I have a million subscribers. I make a shocking amount of money to just create content that is entirely what I want to create. And it took those 6 years, really the last 2 years have turned into that. I took about 3-4 years of that same drive that I had as a hairdresser and a mediocre rock singer and a low-level mixed martial arts professional. I applied that drive in my 50s to understanding this. And now I have a big digital business and I'm totally free to do whatever I want.
I've been an entrepreneur since I started my first company at 16. I've been an entrepreneur since I was 19. I've been 27 years solo doing my own thing. I have a few corporations and everything. I look at you from a young age, you were always an entrepreneur. From your hairdressing, yeah. You might have worked at a studio, but you booked your own clients. You did your own thing as a musician. You booked your own gigs.
I just rented the chair.
You've always been an entrepreneur. And I think that drive, I always compare the top level entrepreneurs in the world are very comparable to the top athletes in the world. You have to be self-driven. You have to be at that level. There's no one that's going to control your destiny and set yourself. And like you said before, I use this word all the time, is being able to pivot and be able to control your own destiny by pivoting when you have to. So I look at you, you always have been an entrepreneur, whether you call yourself that, you call yourself an artist, you are an entrepreneur and you always probably will be. And now you just found your niche where you found where your passion is. And I love it.
Yeah.
I'm loving this story. I love this story.
Thank you. It's fun chatting with you about this because I never get to think about these things very much. You just are living in it, right? I've never thought of myself as an entrepreneur, even today. I've always, in my mind, labeled it as an artist. But an artist who nobody else is going to, like, make a deal for you. Nobody else is going to... The big thing about what I really started to love about working, you know, having building an audience on different platforms with my own work in my own environment wasn't just the freedom. I loved that. But it was also, it started to hit me. And these were the little nuggets that hit me. I remember when I was working a little in the UFC's sort of bubble, Joe Rogan brought me in, actually. Yeah. He literally called me. I'd asked him for advice. He called me and he said, man, like, I want to send your stuff to Dana. He sent a bunch of my stuff to Dana. 20 minutes later, he texted me. Dana's freaking out. He asked for your number. So I gave it to him. And then the Monday, Craig Borsari called me and said, we'd like to bring you on. Then I'm coming to the company. And from that moment, you suddenly go, oh, wait a second. You're not being hired to, like, do something. You're just being hired to sit and then try to convince executives to like you, which is not usually done in those environments through the quality of the work. It's done through the right email and sending the right things and you know, saying the right things and acting the right way. And like, I'm like, oh, I'm fucked. I am definitely fucked. This is not going to work out for me.
What year was this then, roughly?
2016. So I was still at Fight Network when Rogan had brought me in, and I started doing some breakdowns for the digital department at the UFC. And then I did some bunch of different commentary on Fight Pass for them that they would fly me to. I did one piece. So Dana told the senior vice president of whatever booking and create, the guy who runs all the jobs, I want to try him on commentary. So, and meanwhile, they didn't know I'd already done 600 shows. So I did a Judo Brazil. And it went pretty well. And then we went on vacation. The next one was 4 weeks later, and I found out Michael Bisping was doing it. So we go on vacation. We're in Mexico. My wife and I's only vacation of the year. And we said we're going to leave our phones alone. But instead, I look at my phone, and it says Luke Rock, whoever Luke Rockhold was fighting is out. Michael Bisping is in this weekend. And I looked at it, and I said, oh, shit, Mike was supposed to do the show. Like, my way to be commentating at the lowest level of the UFC thing. Wait, Mike's out. And I said to my wife, and we've both been drinking tequila, I said, if I send a text and say, hey, I'm available, and I do this. Now, and this is my error, because I've learned to never expect anyone to remember what you did or to pay you back or whatever. If you do something, you should do it for its own for its own purpose. And I broke that truth because I literally was like, if I jump in now from Mexico and I go to Burbank and I do this show for them, you know, they'll remember it. And this might be the key to it. I could be sitting next to Rogan and Anna in a year from now and it'll be great. And she goes, just send the email. So send the email. We come back and the guy writes, you're my Huckleberry. We'll send a flight for it. I leave my wife on the beach in Mexico to get on a plane, to go to Burbank, to commentate a show nobody watches on Fight Pass, to let these motherfuckers know that this is the kind of guy I am. That then got me, after that, they gave me the next three. And Dominic Cruz had come up to commentary via this route with about five. And I did the next two or three. Then they gave me the next three or four. And just as I had said, okay, I'm down for those next three or four. And I thought, shit, I'm going to be like doing a UFC after this. They were sold to Endeavor. And that thing ceased to exist. That gig ceased to exist. And all their internal shuffling happened as happens at big companies. People are laid off and stuff. And I fall through the cracks. And a year later, I've had no work with them. And, you know, obviously, now you're thinking, they'll remember I left my wife on the beach to come do this, because that obviously they have 100,000 other things happen. And eventually I was just like, I can't stay hanging in here. So I wrote a text or an email, and I since apologized, but I wrote a text or an email to that vice president and said, fuck this. I'm going to Singapore. I'm going to go meet with Chatri. This is bullshit. Besides, I don't really like these shows anyways. I literally did that. And I for real did that. I've since apologized. It's like, that's rude. But I did that to free my mind of sitting there waiting, checking emails, sending the right. It was all against my authentic way of thinking. begging and you know, brown nosing, all that. I don't believe in it. I don't believe it's the way to live. And I was doing it. And this is a quick aside. When I played in my band, we had a real audience that really liked us. And we had an online presence that was much bigger than how we were in the world. And chat rooms and message boards, those were our audience. And I spent a lot of time trying to get major labels to sign my band when I really should have spent that time serving that audience. Yeah. And it was undermining my relationship with that audience. It was disrespectful. And why do I want some major label to do that? Is it because I want to feel accepted? Is it because I want to feel special? Is it because the teenage me thinks it would be really amazing to tell my friends I'm a major label? Why am I begging these guys? And I remember thinking after, I'm never going to do that again. And then I find myself doing that with the UFC. I find myself begging this senior vice president or whatever for gigs and sending follow-up emails. And suddenly I'm like, no, not again. So I sent a sort of a self-destruct, go fuck yourself email. And then I sailed away from that and then moved all in into the direction that I am right now. I did go to Singapore and I did interview with One Championship. I was there for 12 or 13 days. I interviewed with Rich Franklin and Chatry and three or four other people. And they kind of started the negotiation process of me working for them. It was the same kind of thing. It was, I liked them. I liked what was happening. I liked what. But I went to them and I said, if I'm going to be exclusive and not be able to make my own stuff my way, I want a shitload of money because that'll also mean you've spent a shitload of money. So you're going to use me now.
Yeah.
And when we started going down that road of a shitload of money, we sort of petered out. Again, in retrospect, I feel like it was a self-destruct thing. That was the wrong path for me. This was the right path. And I knew it intuitively. And so I've kind of burned the boats a couple of times to force myself out into this water where I am, where I have no choice but to do it myself. Every single time a large corporate offer comes my way, I have that same process. This is wrong for you. This is not the way you should go. And I, you know, freedom-wise, art-wise, audience-wise, happiness-wise, money-wise, I'm way ahead having done it this way. But it's dangerous and scary and at first. And you don't know you're going to end up sitting here talking to your friend Jeff about how well it's going. 3 years ago, I hoped that was the case. Or 4 years ago, I hoped that was the case. Now that it is the case, I don't want to act like I always knew it was going to work because it was scary. It was really scary to be on your own doing it yourself.
But that's what makes it so much rewarding, so much more rewarding, so much more beautiful, right? Is that journey of the unknown, but the back of your head is that progression of all those little baby steps. It's a domino effect.
Yeah.
It is crazy when you say 800 episodes. Like, there's so much behind the scenes. There's people look at an individual like yourself or an individual like myself that, for example, I have a Kimura word for 18 years in January. Like, you look at a progression, you're like, it happened overnight. Nothing happens overnight.
Yeah.
It's that progression. It's that long, beautiful journey that's got you there. That's those wrinkles, those progression that all those learning experiences that made you the man you are today. There's two things I want to talk about. Talking about that, I want to talk about Dana after, but we'll talk about that. I want to talk about your wife.
Yeah.
Because how long have you been married for? And the whole progression of where the journey came from, all that travel and stuff, that's hard on a marriage, right?
Very hard. Yeah. So 12 years we've been married. We've been together for about 14. We had a daughter 2 years ago. Our daughter was born a day after our 10-year anniversary. So you know, 12. She's coming up on 2. We're coming up on 12. The big advantage is, that's a really fascinating line. Like, we'll have to chat again about relationships too, because just this, we could speak for hours on it because it's so mystical. Like, you know, I didn't fall in love with her because it was great that we'd be able to handle things like this. No. I just fell in love with her. And it's fortunate that we can handle stuff like this. So a lot of these things in life are good luck, but I didn't fall in love with her because she was a performer. I fell in love with her because I fell in love with her. But the fact that she is a performer has helped a great deal. We understand the offers and auditions and all those things. But also, after we got married, within a couple of months, he went off on a 1 year tour.
Oh, wow.
And I would see her. So when Fight Network was calling everyone to lay them off, I was visiting her in San Diego. She was performing there. So she went up for a year and she would be in a different place for a week. And I visited her every 2 or 3 months and she came home once or twice. So there, we never left the visit without having the next one planned. And there, you work with things like that. So we've both done it and we've both understood it. And we just kind of got good at it. Like we've kind of got good at it.
What does your wife do? What does your wife do performance wise? Just for the audience.
She's in musical theater. So she sings, dances, and acts in large musical productions. She just did Rent. So I live in Stratford, Ontario. That's where I'm sitting right now. And we have a place in Toronto as well. But we bought this big house in Stratford and I got a bunch of Bruce Lee paintings and a bunch of really cool stuff and
I got Bruce Lee. I don't want to turn it, but I got Bruce Lee on this wall here.
Yeah. I got three giant Bruce Lees, each one slightly different. I also have a business relationship with the Bruce Lee Family Company. I do a weekly collab with Bruce Lee on their platforms, right? So, and I don't care what we're talking about.
That is UFC, that's pretty cool. That's pretty cool.
Nothing will ever be cooler for me than that. I've peaked. Like, what? I don't know. Like, there won't be anything ever cooler for me than being a part of a very small, tiny family of people that work for Bruce Lee's actual family, for his daughter Shannon and his family. That to me that'll always be my wife, my daughter. That, I mean, nothing's gonna ever be cooler than that. It's the coolest thing in the whole world, and I'll always think that. If you told me when I was 16 that I would work analyzing Bruce Lee movies at the request of his daughter and her company weekly, there was no Instagram, there was no Facebook then, and I would do it every week. I would have just never believed you. Never in a million years would I have believed you. That's the coolest thing I'll ever do. So we're in Stratford. We moved here around 2017, actually. We had bought the house right around the time that Fight Network laid off everybody, the old house. And then she was in a show here, Rocky Horror. And this year she was in Rent. Yeah. And then we were renting it out in the years between when she didn't work here. But then during COVID, we were like, oh, no, that small town, that's where you got to go right now.
Yeah.
So we were out here during that period. She's a lead performer in large musicals. Yeah. I think she's going to take probably 4, 5, 6 months off. And we're lucky now because my business is successful and happy and joyful. She can work when she finds, if there's a gig that it really excites her. Yeah. And, if that means we all have to move somewhere and use a large amount of her income to make our family comfortable, I can still do my business. And so she'll work, she'll take gigs that are fascinating or big or exciting or dream roles or whatever. But I think she'll take some time off, and which will be, it'll help us all. It's comfortable.
Let's talk about something I'm very passionate about. I got a 15-year-old son. I had a 17-year-old daughter. I'm still the coolest dad in the world at 46. I mean, I drive my kids still to school, to high school every day. I pick them up still. I work out with them every day. Yeah, my daughter is 17, has a boyfriend, but she on weekends wants to hang out with daddy still, which is I've built this incredible relationship with them. Let's talk about fatherhood. How's that changed you?
Yeah.
You're never ready for fatherhood. I don't care who you are, but when it happens, you automatically adjust and it becomes who you are, and it becomes the most important aspect of your life. And I tell everybody that you just look at your kid and it's wintertime in Canada. You're not worried about you putting on the jacket. You're worried about them being bundled up. But if they ate already, how's that changed you? And how is that as a man, but also business wise? And how do you look at the rest of the world now?
Yeah. Everything you and I are saying here, everyone who's a parent is like, oh yeah, totally understand that. And everyone who's not we're talking nonsense. We're talking things that they've heard before and they think everybody just says. They don't realize that it's actually like so true in your skin. Like everything changed immediately. And she's the greatest human being. Like, and anything she ever does ever in her life, nice or kind or smart or anything, happens because my wife and I met. You know what I mean? Like, so now there's all of this is so intertwined. Every aspect of her entire life now connects to the fact that we fell in love and had a family. But she's so amazing. And she falls asleep on me still, almost 2 years old, and every night that I'm home and every afternoon for her nap. And it's like the most meditative thing. Yeah, and it's all different. It's all very different. Art is different for sure. Finance and business is different. Yeah, it's like suddenly now I'm thinking about, oh, wait, I've been lucky to be very successful over the last couple of years, but a different level of success is required to make sure that she's comfortable. One day I will be gone, you know, and that day can happen in a second. Yeah. And so, yeah, everything changes. It's just, again, it's one of these things where it's like, you almost feel like these are platitudes that we're saying, like, because you can't actually speak with enough truthful emotion to get it across. Like, it's so different. Everything is so different. Like, sometimes I literally just stare at her.
Yeah.
And it's, I don't need to do anything else like this. And I'm not really good at sitting. And, you know, for all the things that I'm happy about, the way that I look at the world and the way I behave in the world, the drive and the looking ahead sometimes interferes with the being present. Also why I liked fighting, you better be present, right? And even commentating and stuff we're here right now, we're talking, you know? And when I'm with my daughter, I am so incredibly present. Like I'm just so attached to that's because of her. Like that's because she exists and she's beautiful and special. But these are just words, you know, and words
it's words, but it's words that you as a dad and I appreciate I'm hoping that no matter what, that stays with you because I talk to a lot of dads and that's one thing I am is present. When I'm around my kids, my phone's down. There's a lot of dads as the kids get older, that separation separates.
Yeah.
And you know what? They spend an hour with their kid, but they're not present. The kid's on their phone. They're on their phone. It's being able to have that connection. I still, like I said, my kids, I will go to the gym and we work out together. They're my training partner.
Awesome.
And it's being able to have those moments of presence because there is going to be a time that you're not going to be there. And all you could do is the gifts, all these things you leave for them mean shit. It's the memory bank. Yeah. It's filling that memory bank as much as you possibly can because it does change. Like you said, now you look at the wealth aspect changes where I was the same, where it's like all of a sudden I created a holding company where it's like, I have to focus on real estate. I need to have assets. If I'm not around, I need to have rental. I need to have stuff that I know that my kids are going to be taken care of. And it becomes more prevalent when things in life change because everybody's going to have those 5, 6, 7 moments in your life where it's just like, what the fuck just happened? And when those moments happen, you want to be prepared. So it's being able like that. But all those moments, like you said, just being present, being able to watch them, being able to sit there and just look at her, man, those are priceless. It's that MasterCard commercial, right? It's priceless. It means there's nothing else in the world means anything.
Raymond Daniels, I was just analyzing Karate Combat. And Raymond Daniels, the fighter, and his wife, Shelby Northcutt, Sage's sister. There, Shelby is they're wonderful people, and they had a daughter about 6 months, 5-6 months after mine. And so we were just chatting, and they're like, "Yeah, talking and walking and stuff." And it's amazing. And I said sentences. They said not yet. And I said to them. And my daughter's first full sentence was, "I love you, Dada." And my eyes were lit. They are slightly now. I prepared myself for it as I was saying it out loud. But my eyes started to well up. You know, I'm just standing there in a casino in Las Vegas talking to my friends. And my eyes were welling up at being able to put myself in that moment outside where she says that. And I was just like, "What did you say?" And she said it again. And I'm just like, that's forever. And it's just so... It's just so, you know, I find words to be beautiful. I love poetry and I love trying to describe things. And that's been a part of my job and my passion and is not just the understanding, but then the defining words using language. But in these moments, these words are so limiting. It becomes so limiting. You know, I love my daughter. I mean, that just does not do it. That just doesn't work, you know? And I find that often there's a lot of things in the world where our ability to communicate, it starts to feel so rudimentary when you, and that's also why I just turn off all commentary when I watch martial arts or other related things, because we humans tend to we have mirror neurons and we tend to just repeat the same narratives all the time, you know, striker versus grappler in a stylistic matchup. This guy's got knockout power in both hands. Winner gets the title shot. Boom. Oh my God. Big right hand, ground and pound. It's all over. Wow. We got a new contender in the featherweight division. Like, if you hear that enough, that starts to dominate your thinking. There's only six narratives that they use in mainstream corporate television. Yeah. And then they interchange those five or six narratives, and then they draw a certain conclusion. It's only five or six conclusions. And they say, what's next for this guy? And then we have that pocket. If you do that, it traps you. And this happens in politics. This happens in music. This happens in news. You become trapped. The narratives dominate your thinking to the point that you don't have the ability to think in other ways. And really, for me, looking at the same things over and over, two human beings fighting, I didn't want to just be, you know, a machine, like a mechanical man, as Bruce Lee called them, where you just do the same thing. He did a thing, you say, oh, you know, distance management, another thing happens, you say, there's a volume striker, this other thing happens, he goes, oh, you know, those leg kicks are going to really add up. Like, if you do that, you become that.
Yeah.
And I just didn't want to do that. So hundreds of shows later, I examined things in as many different ways as possible. The musical element to it, rhythm and sound, knowledge, sight, the nervous system, poetry, how does it relate to cooking, like everything possible. And by doing that, I started to see it different. And then it becomes your job in 3 years or 4 years or 5 years. If you're seeing something, can you develop a language with which to get that across in a way that's meaningful to somebody? I don't care if this guy gets a title shot next. I'm happy for him, but I don't care. I care about martial arts. I care about the moments. I care about the lessons that I can learn by what they've overcome and how we can apply those lessons to life. I really don't care if this guy's the sixth ranked, whatever. It's irrelevant to me. And I think it's irrelevant to most people. If they truly looked at the beauty of the moment for what it is, they wouldn't require tool mechanisms like belts and titles and rankings. Those are mechanisms intended to hold your attention long enough for you to separate you from your money and keep you consuming a product. But the dream would be that you then go beyond those things. You don't. Israel Adesanya will tell you, the belt doesn't matter. Why? Because he's transcended the idea of this trinket. What is a belt? Well, a title is something given to somebody who's apparently won some math of a ranking. That title is then represented with a belt. That belt is an object. Like, none of this matters. None of this matters. And it shouldn't matter. It only matters because sometimes we don't really think about things. We just sort of plod along and people tell us what matters and we just go with it. You know, most of the things that are measured are not measured because they're important. They're measured because they're easy to measure. And then we assume they're important, right? This is how the universe works,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And so you could absolutely just do the thing. Show up, strike versus grappling, do your tie, talk nice to the producer, whatever. You 100% can do that. I don't think you're going to find as much joy in it as if you explore something. Of course, fighting is eternally complex and impossible to understand. If you study it for 1,000 more years, when you look at it today, will you think we understood it in a rudimentary way? We didn't even understand how certain senses work and how learning works and what the eye sees and how the brain processes information at the speed, all of these things, right? Of course, we know that if we studied anything for 100 more years, that would be true. And so then, since that is true, what we know today is pretty much rudimentary nonsense, right? So the goal then becomes, rather than fall into the rudimentary nonsense and take the paycheck and play along and be a cog, what could we do possibly with our learning and exploring of this, whether it be making glasses, the technology, martial arts, football, Barbie, you know, creating your own soda brand, whatever it is. The goal in life is to go beyond and learn more and actualize, see what's possible before your death. Leave something meaningful if possible, not just to play the role that you saw this play. And so that to me has been a key driving force as this whole thing has made sense. And now I have a successful business. I'm going to deprioritize money and business and prioritize exploration, curiosity, and learning. and growth. And if I do that, my daughter will be taken care of, because I've learned that by doing that, most people are not doing that.
Yeah.
And when you do something most people don't do, the scarcity has inherent value.
Yeah.
So, and I could say to anybody, if you are making TikTok content or whatever it is you do, doing what everyone else is doing is not going to work for you. Imitating, innovation is always greater than imitation, always. We got to get together during a really great moment where a lot of things are making a lot of sense to me. 18 months from now, the whole thing may make no sense again, because the world's constantly changing. And like you said, you have to understand how and when to pivot. And when you pivot slightly wrong, how to pivot again. You know,
I just by listening to you this last little while, you're in a good place, and it's hard to understand that until you're in that spot. And what you've learned over the last, I would say since 2017 on, I don't think you'll ever go back into a bad spot, because now you've learned that you are the creator of your own destiny. So, and that goes with your art, that goes for even financially, and everything happens for a reason. So now, you have the only difference, or are you now and where you were then, was obviously daughter, marriage. There's different components, but this just adds extra layers of the value of everything you're offering, right? And everything just starts.
You're right. It applies to everything.
Yeah. You're such a good spot.
Yeah, it's true. And the truth is, things change, you know, like I had some very severe injuries that had to be repaired, and I repaired them. You know, I went and I did the physio, saw a regenerative doctor, and got some stem cells and did the things.
Where did you do the stem cells?
So the doctor, Adil Khan, will go to Mexico together to do them, because you're not allowed to do them.
Yeah. So you did that.
Well, yes. And we'll, you know, we'll go to the Middle East next time together and kind of time it. He travels a fair bit, so I try to time my travel. But I had a torn Achilles, and the stem cells healed it fully. And men in their 50s, torn Achilles do not heal.
No, right?
They don't. You get surgeries. And then I had damage to my back, all this from training and fighting, and then holding a baby. Like you're doing all this other stuff, and suddenly static holding of a baby all, you know, every day for an hour a day, suddenly, you know. But and I had it down my spine, and it worked so well that Dr. Adil Khan, he's on TikTok and Instagram, pretty easy to find. He educates people about it on his platforms, but the treatments, you got to go to Mexico to do them. Yeah, the Canadian government's just, you know, slow and weird and stuff. So
I mean, even the U.S. government still, I mean, there's some levels of it you could. There's a couple of guys out of Texas here, Joe Rogan, talk about it all the time, but you have to go to other places to get it done properly, right? I mean, there's so much research behind it, and I don't understand why they're blocking it. It's just crazy. So I don't know if you even want to get into this or not. I just quickly wanted to jump on this, because I know it was a big aspect a few years back with the controversy with Dana White and all that. Like, how was that? Do you have a relationship with him still?
Yeah, actually, I haven't talked to him since. It was great. Like, I was doing Karate Combat, and I've made a video about Francis Ngannou, and I'm kind of looking under the hood of a lot of these things. And in a lot of cases, like, what's easier, you know, whether you live in Canada or America or England, you know, make your country the greatest country in the world, you know, take care of everybody, or convince them that they live in the greatest country in the world, right?
Yeah.
Much easier, much cheaper. This is how politics and media often work, especially large corporate politics. So I kind of looked at this sort of line of the UFC doesn't need the best fighters. They just need to convince people they have the best fighters in the world. They need the best stories. They need the best narratives. And that's true. If some consumers who are not thinking about it and watch only that, they'd be like, what are you talking about? It's way better than Bellator. But if you turned the sound off on all of it and you just watched the combat all over the world, you'd be like, they have 60 or 70% of the best fighters in the world, and maybe 75% of the top 10 in most divisions, but they don't. And that's just factually true. And they now, I don't know what number, but it could be 60% of their new signings come up through the contender series, which is a really cheap, easy contract they get, you sign it in advance, and then they choose you if they want to pay you very little to just be thrown into the mass of it. So that a lot of it goes that way. So I said that. Then Dana, in some interview, and he doesn't always control everything he says super well, started talking, making fun of me. First, he kind of started repeating what I said. And then he realized, wait a sec, what am I doing? And then he just, the guy needs a makeover, make fun of my hair, which is quite silly. And the way I dress, this is what I'm this is what I'm wearing to take my daughter to meet Santa today. Taking my daughter to meet Santa, I'm wearing this. So Dana White made fun of the way I look, which was like, it's a very old school, very retro approach, right?
Yeah.
Very dated. And it helped me immensely, right? Yeah. So like all, there was a deal that I was doing at the time, a brand deal. It was somewhere in around $4,000 or $5,000 a month for a good brand partnership. With all the heat around it, all my platforms exploding, we ended up doing $10,000 a month on just that one deal. If that deal were to last for 2 years, that's $100,000 Dana White made me. Like it happened because he did that, right? And then I was able to honestly respond like a grown up and in my own way, which my audience really liked. And we have a relationship that pissed him off for sure. I could tell he was pissed off, and it was true. They don't need the best fighters, right? They don't. They don't need them. They need the best stories. They need the best narratives. They need the best storytelling. They need the best hype. They need to control what the audience sees and believes. So that's what they need. But yeah, he was upset. We were talking only 10 weeks earlier about Power Slap. We were texting back and forth about Power Slap, and I had some insights into it. I'm not going to share them right now, but some insights into it, actually. There are aspects of it that people don't quite understand and people don't know how to verbalize that will make it, that could make it appear less horrific than it is. But you're not going to accomplish that the way that they kind of heavy-handed hype everything and, yeah, you know, market everything. Oh my God. Like that ain't gonna get you there. But yeah, ultimately, I don't know. We've definitely done stuff together before. He bought me a suit once too. So he did. He pretended he didn't know me, which is a good move on his part, but he does. And generally has always liked me. It was Rogan who brought me to him, and he was the one who said, sign that guy. So, but yeah, when you go outside of the narrative, when you go outside of the structure, every now and again, you get a response. Today, those responses are very beneficial.
I was going
to
say, like, they are.
Yeah,
they
could be very,
very
beneficial.
Very beneficial, especially somebody that has his power and influence targeting you out at that moment. It just brings so much more eyes to you.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I added 80,000 followers. And which, again, like from an art standpoint, that's a lot of human beings to share your art with.
Yeah.
And then from a business standpoint, the bigger that of a true audience committed audience that you have, the more value you have to somebody. If the big issue is, you know, I'm very selective in any kind of partnership, because number one is always the audience.
Yeah.
Taking care of the audience, giving them what they want, asking very little from them in return, as little as humanly possible. Here, cool art, take it, it's yours, I love it, and thank you for watching. So you can't ask them, I believe you can't just keep selling them CBD and protein powder, or eventually they're like, this guy just sells protein powder. I thought he loved martial arts. And the truth is, I love martial arts. And you don't have to be in a rush to take every dollar that is laid on the table. Sometimes it's about the art. And we talked about this a lot. Sometimes deprioritizing the money and prioritizing the art and the quality and the relationship with the humans that and your gratitude for the humans that consume it. Real people, these are people, they're not numbers.
Yeah.
This, like, that person who watched my breakdown and liked it and sent a comment, he lives somewhere with his family and he has a job and he has passions and love. That's a real person. Yeah. Like, don't disrespect these people. Don't try to mine them. They're people. Be thankful for them, you know?
I love that. Mount Rushmore of fighting. Give me your Mount Rushmore.
I think the most important martial artist was Bruce Lee, but did very little fighting. I did a breakdown of some of his live sparring. That's the most important martial artist of the modern era. You know, I'm going like Sun Tzu, Musashi, Bruce Lee. God, I just want something modern and cool to add there, but I don't. Who would we add to that?
Canadian content. I mean, if you're going to go MMA, somebody that's changed the platform, somebody you talk to on a regular basis, right?
Yeah.
I would
Can you imagine if George St. Pierre watches me say, and George's a friend and a wonderful guy, that my Mount Rushmore of martial arts is Bruce Lee.
Okay, let's bring it. Let's separate it.
Sun Tzu and George St. Pierre.
Let's separate.
He'd love it. It'd be the greatest compliment you could ever give someone.
Maybe we separate into MMA and then martial art. I think there's a big separation there when you look at it. Let's go get MMA. Let's look at modern MMA.
I can't.
You can't, huh?
I can't. No, because the idea of taking things in just the sport environment, I just don't. I don't have a lot of interest in MMA. I have a lot of interest in the martial art that happened within the confines of this rule structure.
Yeah.
I don't like sports. I like art. You know, I like human movement. I like combat. I don't like sports stories and sports news. So I no longer look at MMA as some unique and special rare thing. It's simply an environment in which cool martial arts can happen within certain parameters. That's what it is to me. And I got there by commentating the World Wushu Championships in Russia and, you know, the World Combat Games and China and Russia and all these things. When I was doing 18 different martial arts a day, suddenly MMA didn't feel like some vital, rare, special thing. It's just like, all right, two human beings are going to fight within certain parameters that are laid out here. Rule, time, space, environment, rule structure. The fact that it happens to be a popular sport is incidental to me.
Yeah.
I just like martial arts.
I love that. Yes.
My wife is saying we have to pick up my daughter. Thank this you so been, much for hanging.
This has been incredible, brother. I appreciate it. This has been such a wonderful... There's so much I want to talk about. We're going to have you back on in the new year sometime because there's so much more I wanted to talk about. This has been awesome. I appreciate you, brother.
And you too. Enjoy the hostilities, my friend.